it wasn't either of the people who recorded it, and there was nobody else in that wing of the building, so we don't really know what that was. But yeah, it was this kind of growl.
Welcome to Paranormal Isles. I'm your host, Angus King. Join me as I explore supernatural occurrences in Aotearoa, New Zealand.
To be quite honest, it's got me stumped. I cannot explain it, and both of us saw the same thing.
Oh, I mean, there was a time many years ago that if you asked me, do I believe in ghosts or do ghosts exist? And I would say, well, I really don't know. I don't know. But now I can with confidence say, yeah, they do. They do exist.
This podcast contains paranormal themes and may not be suitable for all listeners. Discretion is advised. We would like to thank Dr. Paul Davidson from Bite Size Productions for allowing us to use audio from his documentary. You can find a link to the full documentary in the show notes. In New Zealand, in 1978, an unprecedented historic event was about to take place. It was to be the first time that a professional TV crew filmed and documented real-life UFOs. I remember watching the haunting footage on TV when I was 7 years old in Wellington. I was glued to the set. Even though the images captured were not that clear, it was the conviction and undercurrent of fear of the people's voices involved that made me believe that this was real. And that opinion still stands today. So much so that my belief in UFOs has changed from believing to knowing. Their origin is unclear, but they are out there. It was around 11:30 p.m. on the 20th of December 1978 at the Royal New Zealand Air Force Base in Woodburn, Blenheim, which looks out over the Cook Strait, the waters dividing the North and South Islands. Warrant Officer Ian Uffendill was making his final security checks before retiring for the evening when he noticed a large bright light in the sky. At first he thought it may have been a Bristol freighter known for their bright headlights, but when nothing came in to land, he soon realised that this was no aircraft. He said that the object had what looked like landing lights underneath. It suddenly did a split turn, and the landing lights were immediately facing the other way. Then, two more smaller bright lights appeared, and they all hovered there together. The two smaller ones, which were equidistant to the large one, began moving in a perfect arc of a circle around the bigger one, stopping at 90 degrees. Then they all moved together to the west, then the smaller ones moved in tighter to the larger. They would also periodically shine down beams of light. Ian has described them as a mothership controlling two satellites. At this stage, the base had made contact with Wellington's air traffic control, whose radar confirmed that the craft were exactly where they were being seen. On radar duty that night was John Cordy, who had already received reports from the Hutt Valley and throughout Blenheim of strange lights in the sky. Regulation is that every aircraft in the sky has to have clearance from air traffic control, but whatever was out there most certainly did not. John Cordy was rightly perplexed and concerned. More baffling was that from his end, they were flying far too close to each other to be any known aircraft. And given Ian Uffendill's professional experience, his only conclusion was that what he was witnessing was not of this earth. Later that evening, two Argosy Safe Air Company cargo planes were doing their nightly runs between Wellington, Christchurch and Auckland. At this time, Wellington radar was showing not three but five unidentified craft. John Cordy said the larger of the objects was about the same size on radar as a passenger airplane and had just previously moved 90 miles down the east coast where it hovered for 3/4 of an hour, which of course no plane can physically do, before darting off, travelling another 20 miles. Wellington then found that the large object was now flying side by side with one of the Argosy planes, on its port side, matching its speed. The time now was approximately 1:20 a.m, and the plane was passing the area of Kaikoura, near the Clarence River, on the northeast coast of the South Island. Wellington made contact with the Argosy and alerted its captain, Vern Powell, a pilot of 35 years, and First Officer Ian Perry. When they looked out, What they saw shocked them. Vernon was so spooked that the hairs on his neck stood up. Perry reported it was so close it was frightening. It was the size of a house, glowing bright red, and was pear-shaped. Power was purported to say that it was extremely bright and had a red halo around it. They observed two other smaller bright lights as well, flashing constantly. The three objects were also showing up on the plane's internal weather radar. The larger object continued to track with the Argosy for another 20 miles or so, keeping pace with it on the aircraft's wingtip. Back at Wellington Air Traffic Control, John Cordy described the atmosphere as electric, racking their brains to try and work out what the heck these craft were. One thing's for sure, it was no fault of the radar equipment. Everything was working perfectly, and everything they could see was corroborated with what the pilots were seeing and what their equipment was showing, as well as the radar at Christchurch. This was no glitch. This was real. All of a sudden, the object vanished from view and from radar. But the next encounter would give the pilots the shock of their lives. Just as they were about to land at Christchurch Airport, another object came out of nowhere, shooting right in front of the plane from right to left. Captain Vernon estimated the object was travelling about 15,000 kilometres an hour, nearly 12 times the speed of sound. No known human craft can fly anywhere close to that. Luckily, they landed the plane safely. But it wasn't over yet. The other Argosy plane had its own terrifying encounter, as one of the objects came head-to-head with the plane, coming hurtling towards it on an intercept course. Luckily, it flew out of the way just in time, narrowly avoiding disaster. Again, everything was corroborated with air traffic control. What the intentions were of these unknown craft, we don't know. Were they being playful or trying to terrorize? All involved, from the pilots to the radar crew and the Air Force base, all attest to never having encountered anything like this in all their careers. The next day, New Zealand awoke to this story, including multiple reports from members of the public, particularly along the Kaikoura coast, about objects coming down from the sky and lighting up the ground and sea, just like the beams of light that Ian Uffendale of the Air Force Base had observed. All forms of media were reporting it, and suddenly the whole country was abuzz with the extraordinary event. Across the Tasman, Leonard Lee, a producer in Melbourne, Australia for Channel O, caught wind of it and immediately wanted to do a story. He called award-winning journalist Quentin Fogarty, who worked for the station and happened to be holidaying in New Zealand at the time with his wife and children. Kiwi-born Fogarty agreed and rang around to gather a local freelance crew. He secured David Crockett as cameraman and his wife Nairi doing the sound. The plan was to hop aboard the same Argosy cargo plane that was flown by Vern Powell, but this time with a different crew. They were to follow the same route, around the same time, whilst relaying the story of what took place, a recap if you will. But nothing could have prepared them for the extraordinary event that was about to take place, an event that was about to change their lives forever. So 10 days after the event, on December 30, just after midnight, Quentin, David and Nairi boarded the Argosy plane at Wellington Airport. The pilots that evening were Captain Bill Startup and First Officer Bob Gard. The plane took off for Christchurch, and not long after, they started filming. Quentin began by giving an introduction to camera, when all of a sudden Quentin, David and Nairi heard the yell of the captain for them to get up onto the flight deck. The lights were back. Huddled into the cockpit, David hurriedly began filming with Quentin commentating and Nairi crouched behind the pilot seats. Suffice to say, it was cramped and awkward. The energy in the cockpit was palpable. David struggled as best he could with the heavy, cumbersome 16mm camera. Every time he tried to focus on one of the objects, they would disappear from view. He did extremely well to capture what he did. Again, there was one large light and several smaller ones. Quentin said at first they saw the small ones which would pulsate, starting tiny and then growing bigger into great globes.
Now a strong target at 12 o'clock here at 20 miles.
Roger, we have that one also, and quite a good visual display at the moment.
It's showing light.
Hey, Sabbath, looks like a collector of light.
Nairi's account was that she had never seen anything so bright, and these were definitely not any kind of reflection. They were too solid. She said they would dip away and then suddenly reappear elsewhere, which says to me that whatever they were moving at extremely rapid speeds. The brightness of these objects was such that at times the whole plane was completely lit up inside, like it was daylight.
They're still there. You can see one to the right of us is still reasonably bright. We can see them, but it's just about impossible to film them. Because by the time the cameraman gets his focus, knows exactly where they are, they disappear again.
Wellington radar confirmed that the large object was behind them and coming up in formation with them, and its size had increased.
Strong target, right in formation with you now. Could either be left or right, but your target has doubled its size.
This is when Quentin uttered the immortal phrase, "Let's hope they're friendly." Although initially excited, all aboard were becoming increasingly more unnerved. Quentin was heard saying in part of his commentary how frightening it was becoming.
I'm now looking over towards the right of the aircraft, and we have an object confirmed by Wellington radar. It's been following us for quite a while. It emits a very bright white and green light. I must admit, this is just a little bit frightening.
Although his commentary sounded to some to be quite stable, he was anything but. Nairi, herself quite petrified, recounted that Quentin was quite agitated and at one point grabbed a hold of her hands. A testament, though, to his professionalism, to appear to remain in control. Captain Startup then got permission from air traffic control to turn the plane around to follow the larger of the objects that was tailing them to get a better look at it. He circled the plane round towards it, but when they got close, it completely vanished into thin air, visually and from radar. There are, of course, many modern accounts of UFOs doing this, just suddenly vanishing in a blink of an eye. Is it a cloaking device? Or popping in and out of a parallel universe? Who knows? The lights continued to track the plane all the way to Christchurch Airport, where, with a great mix of relief and excitement, they all landed safely. No one was more relieved to be on the ground than Nairi. Even though this was meant to be a single flight job, Quentin, who had strong trepidation, decided to do the return flight to Blenheim Air Base, with the potential to get more footage. This was too good a story to pass up. Cameraman David was up for it, but understandably his wife Nairi was not. She flatly refused. This was certainly risky, unknown territory. Quentin quickly called his friend David Grant, a journalist for TV1 New Zealand, whom he and his family had been holidaying with in Christchurch to bring more 16mm film to the airport, as David Crockett had finished his film reel. David Grant agreed, on one condition. He wanted to join them for the next leg. This also solved the problem of replacing Nairi. An interesting fact is that both David and Nairi Crockett touched the outside of the plane upon landing, purporting that it had a bizarre electric magnetic-like field to its surface. What was the plane exposed to cause this? At roughly 2:15 a.m, the Argosy took off for its final flight, with reports from air traffic control confirming that there were still unidentified objects in the Kaikoura area. And indeed there were. First Officer Bob Gard recounts his thoughts on what he witnessed at one stage. He said there were silvery bright starbursts that shot up in front of the plane, bizarrely going vertically up and down, 6,000 to 8,000 feet, at a speed like it never encountered before. He also recounts the largest object being bright orange in elliptical shape, the most interesting phenomena he'd ever seen. All on board continued to see the objects all the way until they made their final descent into Blenheim. Quentin and his team were invited back to the pilots' homes, where they stayed up all night dissecting and coming to terms with the profound experience. The next morning, the news was out. This was a world first. A professional journalist and crew had just filmed real-life UFOs. The story made waves around the world, and it wasn't long before the skeptics jumped on board. They dismissed it as either a hoax, or they provided a plethora of ridiculous alternative answers. The most common one was that it was Venus shining brightly. Another included lights from squid boats, and more ridiculously, the reflection of moonlight off cabbages. Firstly, Venus hadn't risen. The squid boats that were in the ocean that night were nowhere near there. And the cabbages? Well, one thing's for sure, none of these can be solid objects that chase planes or be picked up on four different radar systems and move faster than the speed of sound. One day after Quentin's story aired on TV, and with the country in a UFO frenzy, the government sent a New Zealand Air Force Orion plane to search the area. After takeoff, both Wellington and Christchurch air traffic control centres reported over 50 strange blips several miles out from the Kaikoura coast. But before the plane got there, they vanished from the screens. Further down the east coast that night in Invercargill, numerous people, including two carloads of police, all reported seeing a strange bright light in the sky. Unfortunately, the airport's radar systems couldn't reach that far to detect it. Around the same time, a TV1 film crew from Christchurch went to the Kaikoura coast in the wee small hours of January 4 and also captured the glowing object for themselves. The TV1 cameraman described the object as an illuminated ping-pong ball with a tinge of red in the center. He faced the same difficulty as David Crockett trying to film it as it was moving so erratically. This looked exactly like the object that David had filmed. The government, after their investigation, then came out and sided with the skeptics, citing unknown natural explanations, like perhaps squid boats, and then proceeded to bury it. Those involved were subject to ridicule by some. Others bizarrely thought that they had hoaxed it for monetary gain. David Crockett, to try and disprove the theory that it was Venus, filmed the planet from the ground with the same camera not long after the flight, and it was just a pinprick, not the massive glowing orb he filmed in the Argosy. After the negative backlash from the story, Channel O producer Leonard Lee travelled to the US with the footage that was shot for Quentin's report to meet with the renowned optical physicist and ufologist Bruce Maccabee. He holds a master's and a PhD in physics and worked for the US Navy science sector, specialising in missile defence systems, laser technology and optical data processing. With his equipment and expertise, he was the go-to man in analysing the film's authenticity. His outcome was that this was no light reflection. They were unidentified flying objects. He is quoted in saying that one would think that the conclusion that several of the sightings involved unidentified objects flying with impunity in the New Zealand airspace would have been sufficient to start an even deeper study of the UFOs. He also told David Crockett, who thought that what he was filming seemed incredibly close, was in fact 5 miles away, but was the size of a two-story house. Also around this whole time was what one New Zealand newspaper described as the Fiordland Triangle at the bottom of the South Island, where two light aircraft vanished, one equipped with an emergency beacon that would send out a continuous signal if the aircraft would accelerate or decelerate suddenly. But no signal was detected. No trace of the planes have ever been found. But the most disturbing documented event just across the Tasman was that of Frederick Valentich, a pilot flying from Melbourne across the Bass Strait to King Island on the 21st of October 1978, 2 months before the Kaikoura events. Flying his Cessna 182 light aircraft, he was partway into the short trip when he reported an unidentified object following him. He reported to Melbourne Air Traffic Control that the craft flew above him at about 1,000 feet, moving at a very high speed. Then it began, as he put it, toying with him, coming in from the west. When he was asked by Air Traffic Control to identify the craft, he replied, "This is not an aircraft." He described it as having a shiny metallic look to it, and green lights underneath. The last thing Melbourne heard was the sound of scraping metal. Then the connection went dead. Frederick and his plane were never seen again. David Crockett said that they had all heard the story of the disappearance of Valentich in the media, which certainly contributed to their fear aboard the Argosy that night. Were they going to suffer the same fate and disappear off the face of the earth? Over the years since the incident, the story has been revisited many times in various books, documentaries, and unsolved mystery shows, But for the most part, other than those interested in the subject, it has long been forgotten. But one thing is certain, that for those involved, it had an overwhelming, profound effect on them. That what they witnessed in the sky those nights was real. That they did indeed have a close encounter with UFOs. The incident in Kaikoura and surrounding area was not just limited to those few weeks. Over the decades, there have been a multitude of reported sightings. It's like that stretch of the East Coast is a UFO highway. Who are they? Are they friendly? Or perhaps they have more insidious motives. Either way, would you dare visit there? Thank you for listening to Paranormal Isles. Myself and co-creator Sonia Lowe look forward to bringing you more episodes.